David's here with us from Charlottesville, Virginia, where he's the director of Mockingbird Ministries and on the staff of Christ Episcopal Church of Charlottesville. He has his degree is from Georgetown in history and German. And prior to being with Mockingbird, he was an itinerant youth minister in the private schools in the Northeast Corridor of our country. He's married to Kate, and they have three sons, and we're thrilled to welcome David Zoll from Charlottesville. Come on up.
Well, I hope you're ready to rock, because that's what we do on Sunday mornings. I'm thrilled to be here. Rob is such a dear to invite me. I've never been to Montgomery, even though my parents lived in Birmingham for many years while I was actually away at college most of that time, but I have a deep fondness for Alabama. So it's thrilled to be here in this incredible room, this incredible space to talk to you about what I hope is a lighter subject. You know, there is so much heavy things going on, not only sort of out there, but, you know, in our own lives. And sometimes it can be a really refreshing thing to talk about something that is a little less contentious or a little less explosive or divisive. And I hopefully music can be that, where it's a refuge for many of us. I, in addition to working for Mockingbird and for preaching at this church up there in Charlottesville, over the last couple of years, I've developed a podcast, which is sort of what men in their 40s, I think, do to hang out with each other. you're supposed to laugh. Where we just talk about music, and we take on different groups, usually from the 70s, sometimes from the 60s, sometimes from the 80s. But we go through one at a time to look at people from, you know, from Cheap Trick to the Beach Boys to Tina Turner to Paul Williams, and kind of all sorts of strange things, drawing out connections in a way that is part trivia and hopefully part depth and really talking about what's going on in our own lives. Because when we talk about music, what's so fun about it is that music is a heart thing. There's so much headiness. There's so much information we receive today. I saw a meme online yesterday that said we are drowning in information and starved for wisdom. That's sort of what it feels like to be alive, I think, in 2019. To be inundated with information and starved for wisdom. Information is often a head thing. But when you get into storytelling, when you get into music, you're dealing with the heart. And so what better way to open this? We're in a Reformed church, so I thought I would quote a reformer. And I will quote Martin Luther and how he characterized music. It's one of my favorite formulations of music as a Christian that exists. It's from his Table Talks. He wrote this. He said, "I have no use for cranks who despise music because it is a gift of God. Music drives away the devil. It makes people gay. They forget thereby all wrath, unchastity, arrogance, and the like. Next after theology, I give music the highest place and greatest honor. I would not exchange what little I know of music for something great." He goes on, he says, "Experience proves that next to the word of God, only music deserves to be extolled as the mistress and governess of the feeling of the human heart. We know that to the devil music is distasteful and insufferable. My heart bubbles up and overflows in response to music, which so often has refreshed me and delivered me from dire plagues." Now, if you know Martin Luther, you ever heard him speak, dire plagues. I mean, he's an intense guy. So he can take talking about something that he loves and turn it into something that is almost you want to run away from. But it's it's beautiful. You know, a lot of people who are familiar with Bach refer to him as the sort of the fifth evangelist. And maybe you are a music person. Maybe you're strictly a rock and roll person. Maybe you're strictly a classical person. Maybe you're a hip hop guy. I don't know. Whatever you are, music is something we gravitate towards because it stirs our heart. It's a heart thing. And as almost everything that involves the heart, we don't get to dictate what it is that moves or touches us. Things like taste, what we respond to, it's instinctual, it's gut level. It is sort of, it exists upstream from the mental processes that kind of deal with information. And often those things which connect with us on a musical level, most deeply, they contain an element of surprise. They catch us off guard and undefended. And they meet us where... Have you ever been in a supermarket and some song comes on and you're transported back to 1972 like that? Or you're like, that was the song that was playing on the first bad date I had, you know? Or that song, I'll never forget it. It was the last song I listened to with so-and-so. It was the song that they wanted at their funeral. Oftentimes, though, it's like the eye of a sudden, I'm a junior in high school, even though I'm, you know, 65 and I'm looking for some, you know, the right kind of garbanzo beans. And here I am weeping in Piggly Wiggly. Maybe you're not like that. I love, there's a story. Anyone know what Pandora is? It's the app on your phone, and it's been around for a while now, and it's sort of like a radio that is, through an algorithm, it finds out what it is you like to listen to, and it designs a radio station that is really just for you. And there's a great story in Pandora's early years where some young man, he was very disturbed because Celine Dion kept coming on his personal radio station that they had designed. And so he wrote to Pandora and he said, guys, something is wrong with the algorithm. I love everything you choose for me, except Celine Dion keeps coming on. And Pandora, they write and they say, well, we checked the algorithm, we've checked your account, and everything seems to be in order. Are you sure you're not choosing to listen to Celine Dion? He said, gosh, no, I can't stand Celine Dion. I'm opposed to everything she's about. I never want to see that Titanic movie ever again. Please, whatever you do, no more Celine Dion. And they said, all right. A couple of weeks go by, more Celine Dion keeps coming on. He emails them again. He says, why is Celine Dion still coming on? And they said, well, we've checked the algorithm again. Everything seems to be in order. And at that moment, the scales fell from his eyes, and he realized, oh, my goodness, I like Celine Dion. We don't get to choose what music we sort of vibe with. We can have all sorts of associations. But what do people say? What's your guilty pleasure? You ever pulled up at a stoplight and you see someone singing along at the top of their lungs to show tunes or something like that? And they think no one can see them, but you can see them? What is it that you listen to when no one's around? This is why music is such a wonderful picture, window into the human spirit. Because it is a spiritual barometer of sorts. Again, this kind of barometric reading can be inconvenient. When what you actually like and what you feel you're supposed to like turn out to be different things. But it's also a clue as to what makes music so, and art more generally, so subversive. Under the guise of escape and distraction, music is capable of connecting us to the reality of who and where we are, our unsifted feelings and desires, as opposed to who we think we should be. Again, music can cut through a facade that you're upholding. It can bring you back to yourself. Nothing actually can bring you back to yourself more quickly than the right song at the right time. I'm convinced. So it's a heart thing. I think it's not just a barometer, though. Music can reach us at an emotional level so deep as to be where we're shut off from other more direct approaches. This is why so many of the movies we love, the music, the score is creates just as much of an emotional response in us as the actual scene. Just as much. I mean, you know, when they play that, when that Coldplay song comes on at the end, there's going to be some, you know, two lovers running together and against all odds, really going to be. It wouldn't be the same if there weren't sort of swooning strings and choruses of angels singing. So, this all brings me to High Fidelity, one of my favorite movies from the, I guess it's from the 90s or it's the early 2000s. Anyone know the movie High Fidelity? It's based on the book by Nick Hornby, English writer, starring John Cusack, a young Jack Black. It is about record store clerks, and it's about a tribe of people that I very much identify with, which are record store snobs. Okay? We're not proud. Actually, we are very proud, and that's sort of the problem. I remember when I first met my wife, one of the main things I had to get over was that she had said she liked a certain group that I couldn't handle anyone I was associated with actually taking seriously. Now, that was a judgment on me, not on her, that I would be that superficial and I could possibly, you know, anyway, that's a totally different story. High Fidelity. This is how the movie starts out. You don't need to know anything else about the movie, but it asks a very important question. We're going to watch this clip.
What came first? The music or the misery? People worry about kids playing with guns or watching violent videos. Some sort of culture of violence will take them over. Nobody worries about kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
My desert island. All time, top five most memorable breakups in chronological order are as follows. Allison Ashmore, Penny Hardwick, Jackie Alden, Charlie Nicholson, and Sarah Kendrew. Those were the ones that really hurt. Can you see your name on that list, Laura? Maybe you'd sneak into the top 10. But there's just no room for you in the top five. Sorry! Those places are reserved for the kind of humiliation and heartbreak you're just not capable of delivering.
If you really wanted to mess me up, you should have got to me earlier!
You hear that? If you really wanted to mess me up, you should have gotten to me earlier. This is the great question that he's asking. Is miserable because he listens to pop music? Or does he listen to pop music because he's miserable? All right? His question is, people worry about the impact of kids playing violent video games, but no one seems to talk about the impact of us listening to thousands upon thousands of songs about heartbreak, loss, rejection, and pain. And it's a great opening question, I think, in this. And, of course, this triggers him to think about all the times he's been rejected. He gives you his top five worst breakups. Then he yells at the woman who's just broken up with him that she didn't even make the list. And then what's the next thing he does? He pumps up the music because he wants to feel even more. He wants to feel even more that righteous indignation, that mixture of rejection and heartbreak and resentment that sometimes music can be the perfect soundtrack for, where we can indulge in that a little bit, or at least we can allow us to feel something that otherwise feels unacceptable. Now, Rob mentioned that I was a youth minister in boarding schools, of all places, for 5 years before we started Mockingbird. And the question that I encountered as it relates to music most often probably won't surprise you. Once my students realized just how much of a music freak I was, they would always seek my input on what they should listen to. What should be embraced and what should be avoided? What's the right music to listen to? What's commendable from a Christian standpoint and what's not? What's the line, where is the line between appropriate and inappropriate? Now, I think that curiosity is great, is a wonderful curiosity, and a lot of youth ministers and a lot of ministers of period, a lot of parents have wonderful thought and wisdom to share on that score. They can tell you that, you know, some music is going to make you, take you places you don't really want to go. And some is going to be very helpful in sort of allowing you to heal. And there's, you don't know what is what exactly. It's not a, the amount of, every person you ask is going to have a slightly different definition of that. Now, I'm not here to tell you what's the good, what's the righteous or godly music to listen to and what's not. I think that that's actually a better question for parents. But I can look at it a little bit theologically. Because that line of questioning, I think, reveals or exposes a sad truth about the way many of us perceive culture, many of us in the church, how we perceive culture. It becomes an area of life that is completely shrouded in should and ought, in what's right and what's wrong. There's and the second that that comes into it, then we get into a place of guilt and therefore concealment. As I've grown older, the amount of young men, especially, who've grown up in the church, that tell me about their hidden music that they would listen to, their hip-hop, their Eminem tapes, their, Van Halen or whatever it is, that was like such an important thing for them, and that no one was allowed to know that that was what they were actually listening to, and that that was a sort of a source of guilt and shame. And you know, maybe it should have been, I don't know. But that you miss out on the question when you're completely focused on what's right and what's wrong to listen to. You miss out on the deeper question, and which I think is a more biblical question, which is, why is it that I want to listen to what I actually want to listen to? Not why should I or shouldn't listen to something. What is it inside of me that makes me want to consume what I actually do want to consume? Because the Bible, Christian theology, is fairly unclear on the subject of like what's appropriate television to watch, for example. We may be able to cobble together an answer, and it may make good sense, but it will differ from that of our neighbor. Even, I bet you, among even the pastors at this church, everyone would have a slightly different take on that. But Jesus more or less directly addresses the high fidelity question. That question, was I miserable because I listened to pop music, or did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Why do I say that he directly addresses it, even though he didn't have a vinyl collection of any kind? As far as we know, come on, guys, you got to laugh. I'm trying here. Well, Mark records him as saying, nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. Sin flows inside out rather than outside in. Or to paraphrase St. Paul in Romans 5, sin is inherited, not achieved. It can be achieved, but the real problem is that it's inherited, not achieved. In other words, for a piece of music to gain traction, or a piece of culture, a television show, to gain traction in a viewer or a consumer, it has to find an internal foothold first, right? It has to find that internal foothold. So, we listen to pop music because we are miserable, not the other way around. That, I believe, is the New Testament answer. The enemy is not out there, not first and foremost. And when we blame media for our problems with anger or lust or anxiety, we are more often than not ignoring the logs in our own eyes. Now, that doesn't mean that music is by default innocuous or harmless. It clearly has the power to influence or amplify our emotions. But it doesn't have the power to create them completely. I think about this all the time, in that when I was a teenager, we moved to Germany for my father to get a PhD in theology, and from where we were living in, actually, this is before we moved to Birmingham. And when we got there, I was very upset about it. You know, a seventh grader who was just entering into all the things that middle school means for, you know, sports, and you're just sort of discovering girls, and you know, I felt like I was doing okay at my little prep school in Charleston, South Carolina, and then I get yanked and put into a place where I didn't even speak the language, and I knew no one. I was angry about it. And so what was I listening to? Well, it was 1992, so I was obviously listening to Guns N' Roses, okay, and Metallica. These are the things that a young man in 1992 would have listened to. Hip-hop wasn't really on our radar screen in that same way. It was grunge, and it was hair metal. Now, life happened, and adolescents are always sort of angry anyway. And it turns out Germany was wonderful. It was terrible at first, but it got to be pretty great. And then we moved, and I ended up going to boarding school, and once I finally found my feet, guess what I stopped doing? I stopped listening to as much grunge. I just wasn't interested in it. I checked out some stuff about the Beach Boys in the 70s. And all of a sudden I was grooving to Good Vibrations and things like that. Now, if I'd been told in the middle of that, you've got to stop listening to that angry music, it might have been wise of my parents to say that. But on a deeper level, it would have also given me one more thing to be angry about. Whereas they knew, I believe, that once my internal life settled down, my musical taste would actually shift. And that's what happened. That's what I mean when nothing that goes outside a person can defile them. It's what comes out. It's what's already in there. So that's another way of saying, well, let me back up, because I think that the great premise that I'm trying to put forward in this book about music that I wrote, and by the way, I'm so grateful to be able to talk about this because no one is usually interested. And maybe you feel like you're being held hostage right now. I hope not. Because I just wrote a book that's done actually a lot better about secular religion in America and how everything has become... our religious impulses have migrated. And so when Rob asked me to speak about this, I was so flattered. But I was like, are you sure? But here's, maybe it'd be helpful to you. This is what I think as a Christian man in his 40s, and maybe it's naive. But I think that there is reality is singular. There is no difference between what is real for the religious person and the non-religious person. We may interpret things differently from our non-believing neighbor, but those interpretations have little bearing on the truth itself. So there is no distinction between truth and Christian truth. They're the same thing. So the extent to which a song or a movie or a joke is rooted in something real will be the extent to which some connection can be made to truth, even the one who is truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Are you with me on this? Because we sometimes think, well, this is what's true for us, and that's what's true for them. But one of the things that music has, especially listening to people who don't even profess any kind of faith in Christ, is what you realize is that they're flesh and blood, that they're a sinner, and they have a lot of the same longings, but they're dealing with a lot of the same pressures and realities that you are. And this can be a great vehicle of compassion and of unity and of also, understanding. So again, it probably goes without saying that as a Christian, I believe that truth and Christian truth are not two separate things. And so the truth I see corroborated and played out in so many non-Christian artists is threefold. And that's what I'm going to mention, three of them, and then we're actually going to listen to some music. First and most importantly, though, what we see about reality as reflected in rock and roll is the truth of human nature, which the book of Job describes as, quote, man born to trouble just as sparks fly upward. We are our own worst enemies, and suffering, both self-inflicted and otherwise, is the tie that binds our species one to another. This is testified to and attested to in every single song that's really going to grip you. Something about it if it has its basis in the truth that human beings are conflicted and finite and sinful, well, then it's going to be true. They might not want to use the word original sin, but that's the word that applies. Again, original sin is simply human self-centeredness, replicated and evenly distributed. And any work which ignores that reality and puffs up human agency will fall flat eventually. No school of thought has a more sober understanding of human limitation or a more hopeful answer than the Christian one. So music, at its most universal and popular, usually touches on some kind of trouble or conflict, does it not? The conflict between control and surrender, on criticism versus acceptance, on hurt and forgiveness, on achievement and appeasement, on the failure to love and the desire to be loved. These are not just the major themes of life and music, but they are also the major themes of the Bible. The irony here is that some people might say that an honest depiction of sin is the last place you should go for it is quote-unquote Christian music, right? Now, some would say that, well, are you talking about indulging in sin? Are you talking about, baptizing bad behavior through sort of misogynistic or debaucherous, decadent lyrics? That's not what I'm talking about. When you have a song that is confessional in the deep sense, in the sense of, like, I'm in pain and what I'm looking for is some sort of love, that's not indulgent. That's usually there's actually some repentance involved in a lot of great music. So, non-Christian, I think secular music and art often ends up illustrating that aspect of the gospel without realizing it. So if our shared humanity serves as the initial point of connection, two further realities we might recognize are those of law and grace. If I'm in a Reformed church, hopefully you're somewhat familiar with these. These are the distinctions at the heart of the Reformation, that God speaks to us through His law and through His gospel. Through the words of condemnation, thou shalt be perfect as thy heavenly Father is perfect. And the words of grace, of the gospel. Come unto me, all ye who are weary, heavy laden, I will give you rest. This is what the Reformers understood as the great two words, the two voices of God that we can discern in much of Scripture. But if you're not familiar with it, let me give you a refresher course. Law refers to any basis of righteousness, whether it be civil or moral, any authoritative measure or standard from which judgments can be extrapolated. Yes, it could be the capital L law of God, of the Ten Commandments, or of the Sermon on the Mount, and the oughts and the ought nots we find there. But it could equally be, if that's actually true, if that voice of God is really reverberating throughout the world and in the human heart, as Paul says, it's written on the human heart, well, then we'll find reflections of it all sorts of places. And we find somewhat perverted or distorted reflections of the law in what I would call the little L law, which is the law for Madison Avenue. Thou shalt be skinny. Thou shalt be influential. Thou shalt be attractive. Thou shalt be wealthy. Thou shalt have 2.5 children and a SUV and a nice house with 3 bedrooms. I don't know what it is for you, but everyone deals with this sort of condemnation that they are not enough, that it's usually being used to sell stuff to us. Thou shalt be successful. Thou shalt be woke. Thou shalt be intelligent. Maybe it's just the internalized voice of a demanding parent. Wherever that feeling of the fact that you're not enough, which drives so much of our striving and exhaustion. That law's exact form, unlike the law of God, may be fluid, but its accusatory voice never wavers. And that little L law of God instigates the self-justification that occupies so many of our waking hours, as well as the resulting isolation and competition. Now, what am I talking about? Well, I wrote a book called Seculosity, How Career, Parenting, Technology, Food, Politics, and Romance Have Become Our New Religion, and What to Do About It. And that book is a catalog, in my mind, of the way that the law has migrated from basically Sinai, or the Sermon on the Mount, into all sorts of other areas where we seem to feel that if we eat well enough, vote well enough, love well enough, parent well enough, we will be enough. And so you have, instead of just being in church once a week, you're in church constantly, and you go to the gym and you realize that you're under total accusation, and that what's really driving it is a more existential demand. When we talk about 2019 being a fairly merciless time to be alive, that's what we mean. We mean that a lot of people have walked away out of the church doors, but it turns out when you walk out of the church doors, you bring the law with you because it's written in your heart. And it just migrates into other forms. That is and the secular world, as we say, as much as the Christian world, the church is caricatured as judgmental and condemning. The quote unquote secular world is just as much, if not more. The breakthrough of this book, or at least the core thesis of the book, is that when you leave church behind, you don't actually leave behind the voices that are making you feel guilty or not enough. What you leave behind are the voices that are telling you about God's mercy and absolution and forgiveness. Because you'll always have the other voices with you. It's that foreign word, that word from outside of yourself, the word of the gospel, that you've basically just shut yourself off from. And therefore you have a culture of total despair. But I'm not here to really talk about that. I can tell you that the law of cool that occupied so much of my relationship with music, it turned out to be just as cruel a taskmaster as the law of God. Because if anyone's tried to be cool, you know, hip, I don't know what it is today. My kids are too young to really be thinking about these things. Though my son is just, I have a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And they're starting to think about what's cool and what's not cool. Dad, you know, I got to wear shorts even though it's 20 degrees outside. It turns out like every parent has that battle with their young boys. I didn't realize that was coming, but it's come in a major way in my home. The law of cool, though, it's a crueler taskmaster in certain ways than the law of God because it's a moving target. It's constantly changing. What's cool and acceptable and hip and cutting edge today is not going to be that way tomorrow. And a sort of the internet accelerates this stuff. So as much as I wish it were not the case, we do not escape guilt and self-righteousness by leaving church. And this is what all sorts of music attests to. Law is not an exclusively religious reality, but a human one, as is the response to it. Faced with that nagging failure, that condemnation to do or be enough, we rebel or we rationalize, we hide our true selves, and we wonder whether or where any assistance is actually to be found, which is what brings me to the third point of connection that we find in rock and roll, which is, of course, grace, which you can define as love in the midst of deserved judgment. Love in the midst of deserved judgment. So if the law exposes our shortcomings and at worst breeds despair, then grace proves time and again to be the force that inspires service and creativity and hope and vulnerability and new life. And like the law, grace is a reality so powerful that it transcends the ever-shifting zeitgeist in our fickle sensibilities. It is no coincidence that grace lies at the very heart of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Indeed, grace lies at the heart of the universe. It is what Dante referred to as the love that moves the sun and the stars. Now, I'm going to show you a clip that I think illustrates how this plays out in rock and roll. And then we're going to close by listening to one of my favorite rock songs from an unexpected source. So, the Beatles. I imagine we're all familiar with the Beatles. My favorite Beatle, of course, is the religious one, George Harrison. But I also am a sucker for Paul and his melodies. And I went through a phase when I was in my grunge phase where I really liked John because he was the angry one. There was some sort of alchemy that happened with those guys, and it's transcendent, and you know, it's remained with us. The Beatles sell more records every year than they ever have. Right now, they're a sort of a timeless phenomenon. But the guy who doesn't get mentioned that often is Ringo, right? He's a bit of the joke in the group. If you watch, he's the best part of A Hard Day's Night, if you've seen Hard Day's Night recently. And he was an okay drummer, but they often seem to have to make excuses for him. The reason I love Ringo is not just because I'm a Christian and I happen to love underdogs and outcasts. I love him because he provides, in the Beatles anthology, which was the enormously long and but really absorbing and wonderful documentary series that came out about 15 years ago, possibly 20 years ago, he provides the great sermon illustration of the entire thing. Now, if you know the Beatles' history, they formed in the early 60s. They were explosively popular. They did extremely well in America. They were able to anglicize certain basically black traditions and make it very safe for Americans and kind of feed their own culture back to them in a way that was... They were also very funny and very charming, and they had these different personalities. Now, they were recording like 3 records a year for their first 4 years. And then they get to Revolver, which does it very well, and they get to Sgt. Pepper, does well, but their manager dies. Brian Epstein dies, and they're sort of without a rudder in the 1968, and they start recording the White Album. They've been the most famous men in the world for about 4 years at this point, and they've been on an endless cycle of touring and promotion and fame, which does not do good things to the human soul. It doesn't do good things to the preacher soul, as we've seen through many celebrity preachers. It doesn't do good things for a young person's soul, as we've seen through, you know, Britney Spears. I mean, you name it. Fame takes a toll on people. But let's just see what happened. In the middle of the White Album, Ringo walked out. He was going to quit the Beatles. He said, "I've had enough. I can't do this anymore." Let's roll this tape right now.
Suddenly one day, I think Neil or somebody said, "Oh, Ringo's gone on holiday."
I felt 2 things. I felt I wasn't playing great, and the other 3 were really happy, and I was an outsider. And so, you know, I came to this decision, I'm leaving. And so I went to see John, who was living in my apartment in Montague Square. I knocked on the door and I said, hi, we went in. I said, "I'm leaving the group because, you know, I feel like, you know, unloved and out of it. And I'm not playing well and you 3 are really close." And he said, "I thought it was you 3. So, okay. And then I went over to Paul's and knocked on his door. I said the same thing. I said, "You know, I'm leaving the band. I feel, you know, you 3 guys are really close and I'm out of it." And he says, "I thought it was you 3.
So we had to kind of reassure him that we did think he was great. I mean, you know, that's what it's like in life. You go through life, you never stop and say, "Hey, you know what, I think you're great." Well, I don't think we'd ever done any of that with Ringo. It always just been, "Yeah, he's great. And he felt insecure, so we had to, and he left. So we had to kind of go and say, "No, you're great, man, you're the best." And then he said, "Oh, thank you." I think he was pleased to hear that.
You know, and I knew we were just in a messed up stage, all of us, then. You know, it wasn't just me, it was the whole thing was going down. And I came back and went in the studio, and George had it decked out with flowers. It's just flowers everywhere. And John had sent me telegrams saying, "You're the best rock drummer, come on home." and I just felt good about myself again, and you know, we'd got through that little crisis, and it was great. And then the White Album really took off, and like Year Blues, you know, the track Year Blues was great. We all left the studio and went to a little room, so there's no separation, and there was lots of group activity going down. I loved the White Album.
So if you speak Portuguese, you're welcome. Gave you some subtitles there. What have we just witnessed? Well, inside, the most loved foursome in the entire world at that point, the people at the actual top of the pecking order of cool, as well as simply just worldly adulation, there was an inner circle. Inside the innermost inner circle, there was an inner circle. It's this amazing moment where Ringo goes to John and says, "I feel like the 3 of you are really close and I'm on the outside." And he says, "I thought it was you 3. And then George says the same thing, and Paul says the same thing. You see, the law, the distinction that thou shalt be the best, thou shalt be cool, thou shalt be influential. Everyone would say that these guys had fulfilled it. And yet, inside it, they didn't feel like they had. And in fact, all they felt, all Ringo felt, was condemnation. And that he was the only one that didn't belong. Now, by the way, you find that same dynamic at work in churches, in businesses, and yes, even in families. I feel like I'm the black sheep. I'm the odd man out. I don't really belong here. You guys all seem to love each other so much. Isn't that the case? That the law cannot be satisfied by finite, sinful human beings. Of course, once everything is confessed and said and shared, well, what happens? Sins are forgiven, the wound is temporarily healed, and the lads get back together. Their place of love is actually their place of common weakness, of saying, I don't feel like I belong. In that moment, the back of the law is broken and grace enters the picture. And all of a sudden you have a studio being decked out in flowers, in crimson, some would say. And what do? They go and record the most joyful recording session of the entire White Album sessions. And you can hear it on that enormous White Album box set that came out last year. But guess what the song is? Your Blues. Does anyone know that song? It's kind of a song you skip on the White Album if you know it. There's a bunch of those songs on the White Album. But Your Blues is a song that John Lennon wrote, the chorus of which, I feel so lonely I want to die. Yet they describe that common experience as being the most joyful experience of their entire recording career. Now that is the great paradox, I think, of at the heart of our faith and the heart of human life, in that we are together in our loneliness. We are together, the law, we are all condemned by the law. We are all on the outside. And yet at the foot of the cross is where we come together. And the most joyful thing is actually the, have mercy on me, I am a sinner. I feel so lonely, I want to die. The act of saying that is the glue that holds these men together. And it didn't last, it wasn't supernatural, it wasn't the grace of God, but it was a distant echo of it. It was a distant echo of it. And you see stuff like this in music all the time. Now, just let me say in closing before we listen to the last song, the big song I want to hear, the point here is not to assign spiritual intent or importance where there isn't any, or to reduce the beauty and fun of pop music by denying its ineffability, meaning there's something that goes, that operates outside of words. Nor do I mean to trivialize the claims of the Christian faith or venerate a culture that really kind of exacerbates self-indulgence and self-aggrandizing and hurtful nonsense more often than not. But I do not believe that there is a song that has yet been written that can inflict wounds that aren't already there or demolish the hope that was secured on Easter morning. We might therefore, from that confidence, approach the music made by our fellow men and women, not with defensiveness and fear, but with curiosity and humor. We might approach it with the intent to laugh and to cry, to play, to be wowed and to be moved, to be surprised, and even to empathize. To get back in touch with the same, with our vulnerability and our fear, which is exactly the place where God's gospel meets us. Tracing the unintentional but inescapable confidence with which some of this music points to the tragedy of human life and its possible redemption can only deepen our faith. It certainly has mine. And one of the last thing I wanted to play for you before we close, and I can take a couple questions after we listen to this song, is a song that Prince wrote. Anyone like Prince here? A lot of people consider him to be a real genius, and he had to be sort of talked into allowing anyone else to play on his records because he was that prodigious. And he was from Minneapolis, of all places, not where you think a sort of a eccentric soul genius is going to come from. And he was known in his early years for really not only his ingenuity in the studio, but for being a real maven and really getting into sort of his there's no other way to put it, his sexuality and kind of putting it in your face. And yet this man who was so afflicted by talent, and he was afflicted by it. It separated him from other people, and it made him impossible to have relationships. Towards the end of his life, he became a Jehovah's Witness that was about as strict as you could possibly be in that scenario. He did not drink. He did not. There's no extramarital things going on. He was complete. He was actually almost a puritanical about his faith towards the end of his life when he died. The one thing he was also on painkillers, which a lot of these men and women are, which is he died of an overdose, not of a medicated, like an actually prescribed medication. But in his most famous record outside of Purple Rain is one called Sign of the Times. And it's got some psychedelia on there. It's got some raunchy stuff on there. It's got some funk. But in the middle of it, he has a song called The Cross, which sort of knocks you sideways when you listen to it. He was notoriously litigious, so you can't find any of this stuff online in any of these videos. But I happen to have my own sources, as some of us do. And I grew up in the days of Napster. We're going to watch a performance of Prince at the height of his glory. The show-stopping moment of his concerts was always this song called The Cross, which to my mind is this extremely potent testimony that nothing can really obscure the power of that symbol and that account and that historical truth of the cross. He sings, "Black day, stormy night, no love, no hope in sight. Don't cry, he is coming. Don't die without knowing the cross." He continues, "Ghettos to the left of us, flowers to the right. Life is a strange melange of pain and joy. But there'll be bread for all of us if we can just bear the cross. Sweet song of salvation, a pregnant mother sings. She lives in starvation. Her children need all that she brings. We all have our problems, some big, some are small. Soon all of our problems will be taken by the cross." Let's watch this.
Thank you.
Really rock out from there, okay? You have to try and find it. We're going to play it as I guess we'll play it as we leave. Does anyone, I have time for two questions, I think. Does anyone have any thoughts they want to share or questions they want to ask? Yes. Kanye West, you know, the biggest ego in the 50 states. You know, I've listened to interviews with the pastors. I think there was a meme that went around that said, you know, Christians when their friend finally comes to church, like, yes, amazing. Christians when Kanye West goes to church, huh? I'll wait to see what happens here. I get the desire to be a little bit discerning when it comes to him because he's a maniac. I mean, he's a wonderful, God, I think, is using him in interesting ways. He did just write an album called Jesus is King, and there's a record that's coming out in the new year at Christmas time called Jesus is Born. And from what I can tell, it's sincere. Whether that means it's going to stay where it is, he's a very restless soul, but he's also the same guy who wrote Jesus Walks. I happen to not, like, be huge fan of that style of music, but I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I realize he says a lot of crazy things, and you know, he's also got some serious mental problems, I think, that he even sings about. But to have someone of that stature and that free thinking, he's not following any script, which is what I appreciate about Kanye West. He is willing to ruffle feathers on every side of the divide. How it filters down into, I think we need to give him the benefit of the doubt as a young convert to, you know, because people know, like, right when you become a Christian, sometimes you want to tell everyone, and you know, you have kids coming back from Young Life camp and telling their parents that they're not Christians, you know, that sort of thing. Kanye's a little bit in that phase. He doesn't have any theological, like, formation. I think we can, it's going to be awkward to watch that play out on a national stage. I hope that we can be somewhat supportive of him as the church, without knowing that he's just a man and he speaks with no more authority than anyone else.